Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Mate. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, and get bonus content. We really appreciate it because you keep us going. So please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Yeah. And you get Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. We got some great clips on that for you this week. And of course, as always, an extended interview, which you're really going to enjoy because it includes our guest, Gadi Francis, talking about being in Hamas's tunnels.
Yes. Our guest this week, Gadi Francis, is an experienced reporter, reported from Gaza, from Syria. She's based in Beirut and has a lot to say about the latest in this never-ending crisis, all because Joe Biden won't impose a ceasefire because he would rather let Netanyahu risk a regional war and massacre Palestinians at will. So Gadi has a lot to say, and we're very grateful to her for joining us. So stay tuned for that. Before we get to our four basic food groups, I'd like to report a hate crime that I experienced this past weekend. One of the most insulting things that's ever been said about me, and hurtful things. And I'm going to go on record about it right now. I was at a bar with my friend, and I got up to get us a drink. And when I came back, he told me that the table next to us had talked about me when I was gone. And what was said at this table was, "Hey, is that Michael Barbaro?" And if you don't know who Michael Barbaro is, he is the host of the ultra smug, ultra smarmy New York Times podcast, The Daily. And we look, I think, nothing alike. And I would think we sound nothing alike. And our politics, of course, are nothing alike, because basically his thing every week is like, "So are you saying that Hamas is embedded in the hospitals of Gaza and that's why we have to go and bomb them? Like, we have no other choice?" Like, so just to give you an example of what we're talking about here, this is Michael Barbaro covering that Israeli bombing of aid workers from World Central Kitchen a few months ago, okay? And this is how Michael Barbaro covers it on his podcast.
What that suggests, of course, is that this convoy was targeted. Now, whether Israeli officials knew who was in it, whether they were aid workers, seems like a yet unresolved question. But it does feel very clear that the trucks in this convoy were deliberately struck.
So that's just classic Michael Barbaro, like, you know, maybe Israel didn't know that it was bombing all these aid workers in the convoy that it targeted multiple times. And this is who some just reckless, insensitive people in Brooklyn thought I was.
I mean, that's the thing. It's hard. If I were you, I understand you feel like this is a hate crime, like a misidentification, but I wouldn't take it seriously. I couldn't even be offended by it because you look so little like him.
Well, that's what makes it more offensive, is maybe they heard me speaking and they thought that we sounded alike.
You don't sound alike. Now, maybe you said something exonerating. If I know you, Aaron, and I've known you for years now, and we work together, I'm thinking maybe it's the way you constantly exonerate Israel. And they heard yes. you doing that. Yeah. And they confused yeah. you with Barbaro.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, there you have it. I'm not Michael Barbaro.
Is he a short king?
I'm not aware of his height. I don't know. That could be it. If he's a fellow short king, then, yeah. then possibly that's what is the connection.
Yeah.
In which case, I'd have to say I'd develop, my heart would melt a little bit if he was a short king, because, you know, even someone who constantly whitewashes Israel and also the Ukraine proxy war is terrible on that, Russiagate, all the things that I try to debunk. A short king, you know, would sort of, it might get me to be less, I suppose, indignant because, I do have a soft spot for any short right. king. I just do.
For just being part of, so you're saying if someone's part of the SKC, the short king community, it changes things a little.
I think it does. I think it does.
Interesting. It does.
In which case, I apologize profusely to Michael Barbaro. Yeah. I'm sorry for being offended that people mix this up. All right. Anyway, so that's my hate crime report.
Hate crime of the week.
Yeah, hate crime of the week.
Yeah. Hate crime watch.
Somebody thought I was a liberal New York Times podcast host. All right, let's get to our four basic food groups, starting with Democrats suck. The guy who's supposed to be the top U.S. diplomat, Antony Blinken, but it's hard to see if he's engaged in a single act of diplomacy. I haven't seen any evidence for it. But he does put out tweets, and he does pretend to be, interested in things like humanitarian law. So here he is, commemorating the anniversary of the Geneva Conventions, which established, the guiding framework for international humanitarian law. Here he is. Today, we commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Geneva Conventions. The U.S. reaffirms our steadfast commitment to respecting international humanitarian law and mitigating suffering in armed conflict. We call on others to do the same. Okay, so that's Antony Blinken. And how does Antony Blinken model for us how he's going to respect international humanitarian law? Well, one day later, his State Department announced this. U.S. approves $20 billion in weapon sales to Israel amid threat of wider Middle East war. So yes, this announcement of $20 billion in new weapons for Israel was unveiled by Antony Blinken's State Department. So that's how he marks the anniversary of the Geneva Conventions, by sending $20 billion in new weaponry to the biggest violator of the Geneva Conventions in the world, which is Israel.
It's a great way to celebrate it.
To raise awareness about violations of the Geneva Conventions by arming the country that's doing it the most?
Yeah, because he's showing, not telling.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. That's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah. Well, Blinken, the most unusual diplomat I've ever seen, not engaging in any diplomacy and arming serial violators of human rights. This comes after, of course, his State Department did a review of an Israeli unit that was implicated in the torture and murder of an elderly Palestinian American in the occupied West Bank, among other human rights abuses. And Blinken, guess what, said, yeah, after reviewing this, they've undergone remediation, so they've addressed our concerns, so we're going to arm them too. So even like the performative gestures they've taken to make it look as if they're holding Israel to account, even that gets walked back, because now he's arming a unit implicated, directly implicated in egregious human rights abuses in the West Bank. Not that any other Israeli units aren't, but this one was just particularly well known. And then, of course, he also recently announced that the U.S. is arming Saudi Arabia after making a big show of that. Remember when Biden ran, he said, we're not going to arm Saudi Arabia. We're going to make
a pariah nation.
Yeah, well, forget that. Now he's arming them again.
I mean, also not to mention the fact that we have video of Israeli soldiers behind a cover sexually assaulting a prisoner. I mean, this is something you may not know if you live in the United States or in the West, because our media doesn't show it, but the Israeli media shows it. And we have reports of someone being hospitalized, and we have actual Knesset members saying it is legitimate to insert sticks into someone's rectum.
And do you know how the New York Times covered this story? Okay. Have you seen this headline, Katie, from the New York Times?
I don't think so.
Oh my God. Okay. This is just classic New York Times. Look at how they cover the whole, right to rape rallies in Israel. Okay. Unrest at Army base highlights a long battle for Israel's soul. Okay. So it's like people are rioting for the right of soldiers to rape the soldiers are getting off. And for the New York Times, rather than saying, you know, Israelis are openly rioting to support rape, it's a battle for Israel's soul. Everything is always about Israel's soul, yeah. Like this, like, you know, tormented soul, like as they mass murder in Gaza, as they sexually abuse prisoners. It's all about Israel's soul, like not about the actual victims of their brutality.
Right. Who I guess the New York Times, I guess, sees as soulless. So
that's
they don't
exactly
have to worry
right.
about their souls, right?
That's exactly right. They literally do. I mean, how else could you pretty much ignore all these stories and downplay them and make this all about Israel, is if you don't see Palestinians as equal human beings? The New York Times clearly doesn't, just like the Biden administration and everybody else in power in Washington.
Can you just imagine for 1 second if like one person in Palestine, like, I mean, this would never happen, this parallel, but if one person from Palestine had a protest or something calling for the rape of captives, can you imagine the media coverage it would get in the West?
Yeah, it would not be about a battle for Palestine's soul. It would be about, look, more evidence of these savages. And again, yeah. The irony of, you know, Israelis, you know, openly practicing sexual assault, rape of prisoners, but yet the focus has been on these fabricated claims of right. Hamas sexual violence since October 7th. I mean, it just keeps getting more and more gruesome.
Yeah. Why aren't they talking about Israelis weaponizing rape as a weapon of war when we actually know that has happened because the Israeli police had to look into it?
Anyway, this is what happens when you talk about Israel. You just, there's no shortage of atrocities just to keep discussing, and it never ends. And our leaders in Washington, especially the Biden administration, are doing nothing to stop it.
Yeah.
What do we have for Republican suck?
So for Republican suck, let's take a look at some comments made by Donald Trump during an ex, formerly known as Twitter, Spaces conversation.
I want to close up Department of Education, move education back to the states where states like Iowa, where states like Idaho, you know, not every state will do great, but of the 50, I would bet that 35 would do great. And 15 of them, or, you know, 20 of them will be as good as Norway. You know, Norway is considered great. If you moved education back to the 50, you'll have some that won't do well, but they'll actually be forced to do better because it'll be a pretty bad situation. Well, it'd be unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't really know where to go with this, except that it makes no sense. I can't even follow what he's saying. Reminds me of something Trump once said about Joe Biden. I don't understand what he said, and neither does he. I don't think he understands what he's saying. He's praising Norway, which is interesting because Norway isn't exactly a free market society. It is in Scandinavia. And, you know, Idaho, which he mentions, does not have a good education system. Elon Musk is excited by this. The interesting thing is that getting rid of the Department of Education is something in Project 2025, which is something that the Heritage Foundation, the right-wing Heritage Foundation, has put out.
Which the Trump team is really trying to distance itself from. They're like, we have nothing to do with it, even though, like, J.D. Vance wrote the foreword to the author's book, right. And they claim that Trump is totally involved, and they've basically, even the lead author has, like, delayed his book that is coming up because he wants to put it out after the election because he doesn't want to draw attention to Project 2025. So they're obviously trying to distance themselves from it. But my favorite part there is when Trump says, yeah, some states are going to do worse.
Yeah.
Right. But then he says, but they'll be forced to do better. So like, which is it? If they're going to do worse, how will they do better?
I mean, it's almost like spoken word poetry at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just about vibes.
That's the first clip I've heard from that Elon Trump sit down. And man, if that's what it was like for the full session, that sounds like a tough listen.
Yeah. So what do we have for Isn't That Weird?
Well, for Isn't That Weird, you know, we like to stay up to date on pop culture, you know, bring you the latest in entertainment. And what are the hot singles on the tracks making their ways up the charts? You know, what's everyone listening to? Like, what's the vibe right now? Well, we're very proud to bring you what, for some people listening to the show or watching the show, will be an exclusive. You probably haven't heard the song yet, but it's a banger. It's by the musical artist Ted Nugent, who I'm sure everyone in the Useful Idiots community is a big fan of, and his son. And they have taken a recent, you know, tragic event, which is the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, and turned it into a new track. So let's take a listen. There's a lesson there. Whoever, I mean, the lyrics are, they shot Trump, right? Like, or who shot Trump? They effed up.
Right.
The implication being that this was not just a lone gunman,
right?
The one who was killed, but part of a wider conspiracy. And Ted Nugent is here to say that they effed up.
Yeah, Ted Nugent and his son Rocco. And what's interesting is if you see on the text of that video, it says by Ted Nugent, and that's all in caps. And then underneath it, it says, and Rocco in lowercase, which is kind of offensive. You'd think that Ted would be secure enough in his fame to let his son also have all caps.
You know, what'd be funny is if like the failure to properly credit Rocco and led to a dispute amongst the artists. And then Rocco imported a diss track against Ted Nugent for failing to credit them. And it was about like, who failed to credit us for the song? They shot Trump.
Right.
You know, he fucked up, you know, and then you could have a battle.
Or they fucked up because it may be more than, it may be a conspiracy. All right. Well, that is indeed weird. For isn't that terrible? Let's turn to the New York Post, such a great, reliable source for weirds and terribles. This headline says, too fat husband granted divorce after wife demands a fee for incompetent sex. So this is a story that comes from Taiwan. And what happened is that this man, Hao, who married his wife, Zhuan, in 2014, they have two children. But unfortunately for him, the wife restricted sex to only once a month. And her complaint was that he was too overweight. And not only did she restrict it, she said he was too fat and he was incompetent. And then it's not just that, not just did she restrict it, but she charged him $15 whenever he wanted to not only have sex, but eat, but also talk. This husband filed for divorce. He said that the marriage was cold and difficult to fix. The woman didn't want a divorce, though, which is interesting. But the judge sided with the husband, granting him the right to divorce his wife, who was charging him for sex and conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone has to make compromises to be in a relationship, go the extra mile to make it work. But I think paying up for sex is, you know, whatever the issue is, you know, she has, I don't think that's a reasonable demand on the wife's part, you know, I mean, but then again, hey, who are we to judge? Everyone's got different ways of being in a relationship. And, you know, maybe she will find someone who'll be willing to pay over to fork up if the sex is not competent enough. I mean, you never know.
Or maybe she can find someone who has like a sex worker fantasy. Like where they want to do role play as like a sex worker and client thing. That could work too. Mm. Yeah.
Well, useful idiots, your one-stop shop for eroticism and role play talk. I mean, this is maybe the new direction of the show.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah, this is what we'll do from now on every single week.
This
yeah, why not?
Lane. You know, why not? Yeah.
We're always looking to adapt and fit with the times. So yeah, stay tuned, everybody. Useful idiots, your new favorite source for erotica. And sex advice. Just kidding. We will never cover anything to do with intercourse ever again. Okay, that was the last time, we promise.
Yeah, first and last. Yeah.
All right, and those have been your four basic food groups.
When Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, he already had three missed calls from Chuck Norris.
We all know the man, the myth, and the legend of Chuck Norris. But did you know that in his 80s, he's still alive and kicking butt? Either that or death is too afraid to tell him the news. Chuck wants to share with you what gives him so much energy to work out, stay active, and keep up with his grandkids. He did this just by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s.
And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful.
This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
For this week's guest, we are joined by Hadi Francis. She is a journalist based in Beirut, Lebanon, has been covering West Asia, or you know, what's known here as the Middle East, for many years, has done extensive reporting from Gaza, from Syria, from Iraq. Very knowledgeable about the region. We're very excited to talk to her about all the latest in carnage and escalation. She has a lot to say. So let's go to Hadi Francis.
Heidi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start off by asking you a question about resistance and what it means to you and how you and others in the region in which you live practice it and how it's misunderstood by the West.
Well, at that point, you know, I was thinking, preparing myself to this discussion with you guys, like, I don't really care what the West thinks and what they identify and how the narrative goes over there. When you're like 10 months into massacre, you really don't care about political correctness. The West identifies us as subhumans. Why would they identify our resistance as something fair or just? To me, even existing, even being alive is resisting. To start with, because we have been annihilated, we have been persecuted and oppressed generationally, generation after generation. They tried everything, killing, forced exodus, migration, oppression. We're not entitled to the same education, to the same travel, to the same exploration around the world. We're not entitled to the same human rights. So just that you existed, that you survived the epidemics, you have resisted to start with. When we speak about the armed resistance, this is the more complex after 76 years of persecution. We don't only want to survive. We want to actually liberate our land. We want to actually make better futures for our children. So it wasn't only about surviving or maintaining our land, fighting back the colonizer. It's also now to, when nobody really came to the rescue, not the United Nations, not the nations, not the West, not the East, not the brothers, not the Arabians. Nobody came to the rescue. So at that point, you really say, to hell with the political correctness and to hell with the peace. We don't want peace. We want to survive. And when someone else is killing your infants, you only have to be like God or a prophet to be able to forgive and forgive and forgive and forgive decade after decade after decade. So the armed resistance in Lebanon and in Palestine and in Yemen and in Iraq is just the reaction to the decades of oppression, to the decades of blood. You see, you guys, like, you are seeing now the tremendous obnoxious videos and feeds coming out from Gaza. I tell you, this is not new. The same things have been happening. And even when the Haganah came in 1948, they did rape, they did mass rapes, they did the same kinds of crimes, but cameras weren't there and social media wasn't there. And the mainstream media that is today warmongering over our dead bodies was doing the same with little evidence to the other narrative. So at that point, this ongoing massacre for decade after decade only breeds armed resistance. So in general, the concept of resistance, going back to what you think, the concept of resistance, to me, it's the concept of life at that point. As a Lebanese woman who really would want to remain in Lebanon to give my kids a future that I couldn't have, less PTSD, for example. That's my dream at that point, to not breed trauma to the next generation of my nieces and nephews. I don't have kids. I don't dare to have kids because of the trauma. I mean, if we want to start, everything is resistance. Talking to you right now is resistance.
And can you talk about the role of Hezbollah in this resistance?
Yes, Hezbollah came after the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979. But since 1948 and since even before Palestine was taken from us, the people of the land have had resistance movements. We have had tens of martyrs, political thinkers, journalists, and also fighters. Some were just olive oil farmers and olive oil trade personnel and doctors in Palestine. Everybody was persecuted and everybody tried to resist. But Hezbollah as an organization came after the name, came after the Islamic Revolution won the lead in Iran. But the same people, the same Lebanese people were fighting Israel in a different way before that. They were sectarian, they were secular. They were Christians, they were communists, they were nationalists, they were atheists. They were all kinds of people fighting because it's not a religious fight here. It is fighting the colonization. But today, I mean decades, 40 decades and plus after the establishment of Hezbollah as an organization, it has proven that it is tremendously capable, way more capable than the other resistances. Yes, because it has Iran, and yes, because it has this ideology. And the ideology gives so much confidence to these fighters and patience and resilience to their families. If you look and track how every family from the Hezbollah commanders and the Hezbollah fighters that are dying in this war, if you just make a small comparison to how the Israeli soldiers are being received. I mean, I can only remember Amin Badreddin, who was assassinated last week. He's a fighter. He was my friend in the university. He was so cool. He used to wear baggy jeans and he's like trilingual. This is what a Hezbollah fighter is. It's not like someone sitting in a mountain who doesn't know people. He's like, he's our friend in the university. So in his when he was martyred, his wife had this big smile. And she wrote on her social media, she wrote, "I'm smiling because I'm not going to give those killers the pleasure to see us cry or to see us weak." So these people have built up the confidence and the patience, and it is really rooted in the ideology, and it is very, very of the essence in trying to decode why Hezbollah has really maintained a bigger, let's say, bigger audience and bigger collective approval in Lebanon than any other resistance group in the past. Because we have had SSMP, we have had the Communist Party, we have had Al-Jabha al-Sha'bi, and even some political Palestinian political groups. Everybody fought Israel from Lebanon, but nobody excelled like Hezbollah did in terms of armed arms and weaponry, because they have the Iranian help, of course, and ideology and exposure and popularity. I mean, they are, regardless of what you hear in the news, they are the most popular political party in Lebanon. In every time there is any kind of parliamentary elections, they get the most votes. And if you want to also exercise the mathematics, each political party in Lebanon, they have the most number of supporters, the most number of fighters, and the biggest power of them all. And this doesn't only have to do with the help of the Iranians, because the Iranians are not present in Lebanon. We don't have Iranian presence in Lebanon. It has to do with their delivery, because they delivered on a day like today. I remember it very well, and it is in our collective memory. We, the Lebanese, won over Israel. We won in 14th of August 2006. After 33 days, the Israelis had killed many of us, had destructed most of our infrastructure, but they couldn't take not one inch of our land. They went back, and the July 2006 war ended with a Lebanese victory that we all revere and we all remember very much. This is also one of the reasons why today Hezbollah is rooted inside the Palestinian cause and inside the Lebanese people's approval or minds, regardless of the politics. When Israel is always telling you they want to kill your children, every single person in Lebanon is going to pray for the victory of Hezbollah over these criminals.
I want to ask your response to the narrative that we get here in NATO land about Hezbollah. So what they'll say is, okay, they'll be like, okay, fine. Yes, Hezbollah, they did have popular support once because they did drive out the Israelis. Okay, fine. But they don't anymore because now the people see them as their existence as a threat to Lebanon because, you know, if Hezbollah just put down its arms, then Israel constantly wouldn't be attacking Lebanon. And also they'll say that during the financial crisis in Lebanon, which has been going on for several years now, Hezbollah has acted to protect the elite and has not acted in the interests of the people. That's the kind of narrative that we'll get. Like, okay, fine, yes, we admit they once were popular, but they're not anymore.
Well, first of all, there's a very big problem in the West now is that they make their own news and they believe it. If you say this, it doesn't make it true. I have a problem with Western media. Like, oh, Hezbollah is not popular because our own American-based journalist in an American outlet told us so. They always get their news from people who are biased. I mean, Hezbollah is under attack today and yesterday and 10 years ago inside the politics. You can say roughly maybe 40% of the country doesn't approve of the politics of Hezbollah. I'd give you that. But the Lebanese people are not that 40%, and it is not an accurate number. This is to start with. When we're speaking about politics, me as a person, I'm with you right now, I am a very vocal opponent to Hezbollah in Lebanon. And like me is every Lebanese, because I don't like the governance, I don't like sectarian groups and the sectarian talk inside the domestic politics. I don't like all the political elite, and I don't like the theft and the fraud that is happening in the governance of Lebanon. But Hezbollah is part of the governance. It's not the whole governance. And the whole governance started after the civil war in Saudi Arabia, where there was a deal between all the militia, the civil war lords, in Saudi Arabia, and there was a deal between Americans, Syrians, and the Saudis. So if we want to talk about the Lebanon governance, we have to name each thing by its name. Hezbollah wasn't in the governance not until after 2005. So they are responsible for that part, if we want to speak and to dissect the Lebanese politics. But then again, Aaron, I think these news always are trying to... We have always had that in Lebanon since the beginning, the formation of Lebanon, because Lebanon is a 100 years old nation, by the way. It's just a part of a greater Syria. It's a mount, Lebanon, that was governed in a different way during the Ottoman Empire. But the whole nation is a greater Syria. So in that nation, when the formation of the modern Lebanon started, there was a kind of alliance between the West and the political elite. And it was like, this would be the Christian country next to the Jewish country, and we will all be different from the other Islam and Arab in the region. So when you see political elite in Lebanon that is pro-Israel or pro the United States, it's not new. It is very formative in Lebanon. There are papers from Eliyahu Sasson's memories and papers, or other Zionist leaders in the formation of the Zionist entity in Palestine. And they speak very well about the relationships with the Lebanese in the formative years of Israel on the land of Palestine. So it is not new to be witnessing people speaking like that in Lebanon, and people really working on the Lebanese differences, on the Lebanese religious differences, or the different fears, or the residues of the civil war, to make Muslims hate Christians and vice versa, and say, no, you prefer Israel. No. But we all know, regards under all that noise, we all know that there is nobody dragging Lebanon into war. There is an expansionist, colonial, apartheid state that is occupying Palestine, and that is every day saying they want to occupy Lebanon and Syria. I mean, they say these things. So we don't need to think about hypothetical realities now, when we have an army, an enemy, telling us every day they want to kill us and actually bombing us. Nobody really thinks that Hezbollah is dragging Lebanon into war. Only the American media outlets and the NATO outlets and their brainwashed audience.
Well, let me give you an example of that, because I was just reading an article in The New Yorker by a journalist named Dexter Filkins, who went to Lebanon and basically wrote an article saying that Hezbollah is dragging Lebanon into war. And he also blamed Iran, because he says basically that Iran is controlling everything that Hezbollah does. And he even got a quote from someone who he says is a Hezbollah commander And I want to get your response to whether you think this person actually is a Hezbollah commander. Okay. This is what Dexter Filkins quotes this Hezbollah commander as saying this, quote, "The Iranians want us to escalate, so we are escalating." Okay. That's according to Dexter Filkins, what he says a Hezbollah commander told him. The Iranians want us to escalate, so we are escalating. And then this purported Hezbollah commander says, "The Iranians control every bullet we have." Based on your experience, Khadi, covering Hezbollah, does this sound like a Hezbollah commander to you?
First of all, if just because we're journalists here, you guys are doing this work, let me just share some information with you. If you want to speak to a Hezbollah commander, it would take you months. And even if you're Lebanese, Ghadi Francis, who is known. I mean, they can. They can through a certain, there is the media office for Hezbollah. They can ask for interviews. But I don't think Hezbollah commanders really care about talking to Dexter at that point. The problem with these people is that when they come, like, I can tell them I'm something and they would believe it because they come with this Orientalist, romanticizing effect. And maybe they saw a Shia person who is pro-Hezbollah and who has been in the South in the past week and he was talking over coffee and he quoted him. We don't take these news at all as, I mean, even if I did believe the Western media, the New Yorker or the New York Times or the Washington Post or all these, I mean, today, after the 40 beheaded imaginary Israeli babies that were never debunked on their first front lines, do I still want to believe them? They made the whole thing. The Anthony Blinken quoted these media places. They legalized an ongoing slaughter over fake news. I don't even want to validate them with even quoting them or their so-called journalists. But we really need to talk about it here for our brains to dissect it. Hezbollah or Al-Qassam Brigade or Saraya Al-Quds or Al-Haras Al-Thawri Al-Irani IRGC or Al-Hashd Al-Shaabi. These people do not talk to Dexters. These people are on the war front lines today. They are talking via their missiles to Amos Hochstein, the American envoy today, the American negotiator. Or the other ones that are going to, whether Jordan going to Iran and elsewhere. So, we are past that point of looking at these articles or really quoting them or taking them into consideration. And anybody who can double check, they know that the way the governance, to talk about the point of that article and to answer your question, the Iranian relationship to these groups, whether it's in Iraq or in Yemen or in Syria or in Lebanon, is very different than the NATO relationship to its proxies. It's very different. There's an ideological oneness. The relationship between Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah is not like, he's not a commander at his service. He is a leader in the Arab world. He's a leader in Lebanon. He might give them arms and help and support, but we make our own decisions. And if you want to dissect how different Lebanon is from Iran, you can take a look at any politician, any Hezbollah politician. They're addressing the other ones, their openness to the other ones. And this is not how the Iranians lead in their politics inside. Why? Because Lebanon is not Iran and Hezbollah is not Iranian. They are Lebanese people. They share with Iran ideology, religious, just like as a Maronite, I share something with the Vatican. It doesn't make me Italian. You know, there is something religious and there is the axis of resistance, this alliance on the military warfare. But Iranians do not tell Lebanese what to do. And I would tell you very proudly, the Lebanese, we tell Iranians what to do in our region. And I'm speaking about Hezbollah because the Syrian war and the amount of Hezbollah deterrence inside Syria against ISIS was governed and led by Hezbollah, not Iran. I know this. I've investigated this and I've reported this. Hezbollah does not follow Iranian lead. Hezbollah is an ally to Iran, not a follower. They have to understand that.
Yeah, and you can say the same thing about, you know, top leaders of Hamas who actually split from Iran and Hezbollah
in Syria.
Over Syria, yeah. You know, which was a major split, which totally undermines the claim that everyone's just following Iran's orders. But let me ask you about that. Is there any still lingering animosity over Hamas splitting from the axis of resistance? Or I shouldn't say Hamas, because there was a split inside Hamas. It's not But some members of Hamas, like Ismail Haniyeh, who recently was assassinated, he split from Iran and Syria and he took the side of the dirty war. Was there any still, is there any lingering animosity from that, or has that all been resolved?
I think the Syrians have taken the higher road about that. Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian governance, they reopened the Hamas offices before that war inside Damascus. It's like they forgave them in a way. And I remember very well, you know, after I went inside Gaza, I had interviewed Mahmoud Zahar, who was not the same stance. I really asked about that because in 2013, when I went to Gaza, there was no Gaza war. There was a Syrian war.
Yeah.
So I was asking about this. And when I came back to Lebanon, I interviewed the Iranian ambassador at the time. He was killed in Saudi Arabia, Ghadan Farrukhan Abadi. And I asked him that. I asked, how come I see Iranian flags in Gaza in support and Hamas headquarters? And I see Hamas fighters fighting your Syrian allies in Syria. So where do you stand with Hamas? And that was a question in an interview, and it was aired on Lebanese OTV. And he asked me with a very diplomatic answer. He answered me, when the Islamic Republic, when the Islamic Revolution won in Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood was the first organization to accredit that, to validate that, to congratulate us. So he was trying to tell me that the alliance between these Islamic groups goes beyond the regime in Syria. This is how I understood that that question. And this takes us to the point that we spoke about before, Aaron. Hezbollah is one thing, Hamas is one thing, Syria is one thing, Iran is one thing, Iraq is one thing. It's only people who come like Dexter and his likes, who come with their own prejudice about the region, that come and look, oh, they're all, these are all the brown guys that fight us. And they think of us as one. We are very different in ideologies, in experiences, in points of views. It's not like we're the same. How can we be the same? And when you go about, when you dissect the part where Hamas is now different, I think there are very different kinds of leaders inside Hamas. I think Yahya Sinwar is very different from Ismail Haniyeh. And I think they're both very different from Abu Ubaidah. They're both very different from Al-Daif. Because these movements or these organizations do not have the luxury to sit and to dissect and to choose one method and one view for everything. They cannot campaign in the way that politics happens in other parts of the world. They're like people who emerge as fighters, as heroes. Most of them are prisoners, ex-prisoners. They're almost assassinated, survivors of assassinations. So each one of these Palestinian leaders has his own experience, has his own path. And I don't think they are all monotonous. I don't think they're the same. I don't think each of them is the same. And this is why we see how the leadership of one person results in a different reality than the leadership of the other. I mean, we're still now talking about Ismail Haniyeh in terms of Syria, but also Ismail Haniyeh has done a lot of renegotiating with the Syrians. So he went to that road after the Qataris in 2011. And then the Qataris came back to Syria speaking in a different tone. And after them came Ismail Haniyeh and the Muslim Brotherhood. It's not about Hamas at that point. Qatar and Saudi Arabia wanted to fight Bashar al-Assad and they failed. And now they want to talk to him. So everybody who was influenced by them in the Sunni Islamic world went both ways behind them. So it wasn't Hamas, it was Qatar. It was Turkey and Qatar, the two allies for Hamas.
Can you talk about Hezbollah's ideology? And I think it's really interesting that you say you don't share their ideology, but you also say it's because of their ideology that they're so successful. And of course, they are based on Islam and you're Christian.
Yeah, it's not only that I'm a Christian. I'm a secular person. I don't believe that religion has anything to do with politics. And I don't believe that religion has anything to do with human relations. Religion is something spiritual. So you know what secular is. Not only because I'm not Islam or because I'm Christian, because even Christian politics and political leaders, I do not ever share the same views with them. The ideology of Hezbollah is not only Islam. It's when we're speaking about the Islamic ideology, it can be really taken into like an array of ideologies. ISIS says they are Islam. And this is where people are like, oh, Islamists, they're scary, whatever. But they are an Islamic resistance that is built on the ideology of Shia, the Al-Ja'fariya, Ithnay Ashariya. And the Shia, they revere Al-Imam Ali and the 12 Imams, and they have the struggle and the fight. They have the fight where which they were never part of the governance of Islam. They were like the opposition. And Al-Hussein, which is Prophet Muhammad's grandson, was martyred in the revolution anti the regime at the time. And then this is their thing. So their ideology is a fighting ideology that believes that death is just another passage, and that they believe that it is only victorious to die on the way of revolution. Just like their imams, all their imams were martyred. All their leaders were martyred. So, and there's a small nuance that is different from other Islam, is that they don't have this problem with Christianity or different kinds of sects. They are accepting of. We've seen some ISIS fighters kill Shia and Christians and Alawites and Druze and Jews together, and Zaradasht and the Yazidis in Iraq. So it's not, they're not the same. They are blended more in this array of this melting pot of culture in our region. There's only the thing when we speak about their ideology, which I don't share, it's the Islamic ideology that takes them into fighting. This Islamic ideology makes people accept the death and the martyrdom, and makes people revere it, and they look forward to it. I mean, I'm remembering Qasem Soleimani in Iraq. Everybody who used to share, because many, many of our colleagues saw him in Iraq and in Syria, he was a man on the ground all the time. He had a prayer every night. They had a night prayer where they would ask God to be martyred. They would pray, please, I want to be killed. I want to be killed. I want to be killed. This is how they pray. So when we're speaking about this ideology, I'm thinking about that. This ideology helps fighters fight more, think less, and they don't care about the costs, and their families as well would accept it. And this would really give the fighter a lot of strength. I mean, if you look at the Israeli fighters on TikTok, and if you look at the Israeli fighters when they're like running because of the sirens, and they still didn't see any massacre the way we are seeing. And when you look at our people inside the massacre, how they are emerging strong and confident, this has to do with their ideology. And it also has to do with the ancestral. Every generation passes on this the sword to the other generation. Like, we've put a lot of blood. I'm talking to you, and it really makes me emotional. I can only think of my dad and my grandfather. I mean, we've all been persecuted here. We've all had to run away to shelters, or to change where we lived, or to see our loved ones killed, or to live around injustice. So it's like every generation passes the sword to the other, saying, we have been through too much for you to give up. Do not give up. And this is how it is for this Islamic ideology. They've been killed and persecuted throughout their whole history in Islam. So they are militants with a backup of ideology since their birth. They know what they want, and they do not change their perspective. When you look at the communists or the nationalists or other people who fought Israel before them and Lebanon, I mean, there are other things, other ideologies that are very important, but sometimes it's not as easy to face death. Yeah. And the religious ideology helped them with that.
There's also an attempt to portray Hezbollah and other resistance as you know, obviously, as like violent terrorists and savages. But when you're talking about death, they actually go, I mean, if you compare the number of civilians that they've killed to the number of civilians that Israel has killed, or not even the number, the proportion, It's not comparable. Can you talk about how Hezbollah fights?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Well, that was really moving, really great, really informative, really exciting to hear from someone who actually lives in Lebanon.
Heidi Francis has been doing journalism for a while now, is very experienced and actually knows the region, unlike some of the Western journalists who we talked about during the episode. And, you know, her, Rania Khalik, are just some of the people who provide a perspective that we don't get in corporate media here. So always grateful to hear from voices like Heidi's.
And make sure you join usefulidiotspodcast.com to hear the full interview with Gadi, where she talks about being in Hamas's tunnels in Gaza.
That's been our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.